Infamous Indy presents The Digging Up Dillinger Project, featuring the Texas Crime Travelers and Travis Thompson. I'm your host, Joe Malillo. In the annals of American crime, few figures loom as large as John Dillinger. A mastermind of bank heists, his name became synonymous with brazen robberies and daring escapes. Questions of whether he escaped an FBI ambush and the whereabouts of his buried loot persevere. History offers one account, but there are whispers that tell us many more. Join us as we go digging up Dillinger. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Digging Up Dillinger, presented by Infamous Indy with the Texas Crime Travelers and Travis Thompson. No relation to the Thompson submachine. Todd Hiles, Stuart Fillmore, Travis Thompson, and me, Joe Malillo, your host. Welcome back, guys. What's up? Another episode.
Hey, what is happening?
Hey. Welcome, everyone.
Love to be here.
We are drinking, having a good old time. We were just saying John Dillinger would probably like us. I think he'd like
hanging out with us. I really do.
I mean,
I think we would like hanging out with him.
So let me tell
you. That's probably very true, Travis.
Before you say that, I just thought of something. In the last episode, you said that you shot Dillinger's Thompson machine gun.
Yes.
Travis, did you get to shoot it too?
I did not. I was back in Mooresville when he went north to film.
Yeah.
The FBI took all the credit, didn't they?
Yeah.
The FBI, they just pushed the small law enforcement out of the way, and they actually got to do it.
That's how it works, man.
He probably said, hey, let's do this after Travis leaves. That way we can shoot it more.
I mean, I had heard rumors about that, but I didn't want to bring it up.
So, to go ahead and continue this theme a little further, not only did I get to continue to Lake County and shoot the machine gun, from there, I got to go with up to Little Bohemia in Wisconsin to film some more up there. And while we were there, I forget what they call it, but Joe, you may know this. On a TV show, you know, when it goes to commercial, during the series of commercials, there's a little piece in there that's maybe about maybe 30 seconds long, not even maybe that long, that they show that's from the show. That's just a little teaser that people, what it does, it hooks people into thinking, oh, the show's back on. And so they stay on, and then maybe they'll just stay with the commercials that continue. So they filmed two or three of these in the bar at Little Bohemia. And as I've maybe mentioned before, you know, I hung out there quite extensively when I was there. And
they're talking about the bar you hung out at.
Yes, in Little Bohemia. And this is where
it's
they filmed
it. It's a historic bar. It was for research, Todd. Take it easy.
So, Todd, I got left out of this too. So
yeah, yes, I believe it.
I believe it.
So I was not in this. I just got to watch it. But so it's Josh Gates, and he's at the bar, and he's talking to the bartender, and Josh says, "Hey, I want to order what Dillinger had. What did Dillinger order when he was here?" And the bartender says, "Oh, it was the ribeye steak." And Josh says, "Well, how did he have it? You know, how did he have it prepared? You know, and was it, you know, well done, medium, rare?" And the guy goes, "Bloody as hell." So, so I thought that was the funniest little segment that they filmed, but that did not end up making it on the show. It was, but I thought that little line, "Bloody," and I think the bartender just came up with that on his own. And I think even Josh was stunned at how well that was, but then they ended up not using it. So anyway,
the cutting room floor is filled with great moments.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, this is a good good point. Why we're doing this podcast is because they don't make good decisions in Hollywood sometimes when it comes to this kind of story. So we're going to talk about it, and we're going to get a little bloody. We're going to get bloody as hell.
Bloody as hell.
On this. I mean, Stuart might get a little tuned up by the time we're done with this, with his all his whiskey.
Here we go. Cheers.
Well, Stuart, remember when we were in Crown Point and we were all on the porch and they were filming us, but we were just sitting there telling jokes and with Josh Gates and my father, Mike Thompson, and none of that made it at all.
Yeah.
None of it. And they filmed it.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And to be clear, Stuart, that's a tease, right? A mid commercial tease. I'm assuming that's what you're talking about, where it kind of gives you the impression you're kind of come back to the show, and then it cuts out to more commercials.
Exactly. Yeah. That may have been what they called it, Joe. But I was thinking there was some little like quick catchy little name for it. Oh, we got a film.
There's also a bumper. There's also something called a bumper.
Okay. That sounds more like it. What they called it. I just don't remember.
Yeah, bumpers are more like 5 seconds. They're like literally.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
They're like station identifiers before. And usually, on what you'll notice on like TLC or Discovery or History Channel or Investigation Discovery, you'll see like quick informational advertisements for like shows that are coming up on History Channel that are like new or different.
Yep.
They'll put those right before they go back to the show that you're watching on the show.
Yeah,
on the network.
Right. Yeah,
but cool. What an experience, Stuart.
It was a blast. And you know, like I said, I was lucky enough to get on two more episodes of that show, not related to Dillinger, but man, you know, so yeah, the FBI kind of came in and pushed Travis and Mike to the side, and then I got all the glory.
Yeah, they didn't want us hanging around no more. We made Stuart look bad, so they're like, "Hey, you got to stay back."
Mr. Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're afraid, you know, if the Dillinger blood and an FBI agent went to Little Bohemia, we might have a reenactment or something. Just, you know. So.
Yeah, and then Stuart would be shooting innocent people. Anyway, because that's what the FBI did. That's what
they did it, man.
That's what the FBI did. They literally killed an innocent person.
They literally killed an innocent civilian. Yep.
Another
and maybe just killed the wrong one in 1934 to buy grass.
And that's exactly which again I think is one of those things that in context could maybe justify or explain why, you know, if there was an imposter.
Yeah, they were just like, don't, well, we did it again.
Oh my God, we already killed a civilian once. We can't do it again.
Well, what about when he's coming out of the biograph, you know, they were supposed to light a cigar. We talked about this. Yeah. And nobody lit a cigar. So, like,
yeah. I don't know if that is maybe just urban legend about the lit cigar. There are very detailed reports about, you know, the takedown or at the Biograph Theater. And I'm not sure I ever really remember seeing anything in the agents themselves that wrote the reports, anything about a lit cigar. Maybe there was. I just don't remember. But the thing that jumps out at me is, No one had actually seen Dillinger in person. They did not know what this guy looked like. And so, you know, they were going on the lady in the orange dress, which the orange dress supposedly looked red in the lights. So how are you sure that this is the woman? The only person that saw Anna Sage prior to this happening was Melvin Purvis. Melvin Purvis was not one of the agents that actually shot Dillinger. So, you know, again, there's just a lot of questions.
Dude, that weighs so heavy with me that like nobody knew what this dude looks like. It's so hard to imagine that in our world now. How could you not know what someone looks like now because of obviously technology and the way things work out? But
driver's license pictures.
There weren't driver's license photos. Now, okay, so like earlier, I think in the last episode, we showed the quick little video of Dillinger that behind bars in Tucson, Arizona, before he was transported to Lake County. Now, you know, there were newsreels. So Dillinger had actually been photographed in newsreels. And, you know, the famous photo at the Crown Point Jail where he's, you know, he's hanging his hand over the sheriff, you know, doing that. You know, so those were available. But no one on that Dillinger squad had seen Dillinger in person. No one knew what this guy looked like. And that, you know, he had had the plastic surgery. He had dyed his hair black. Had the mustache. So, you know, I don't know. If I could time travel and go back and, you know, and be there, I would do it in a heartbeat to see what these guys would have seen when Dillinger came out of that theater.
Yeah. If we're going to go do the time travel discussion, I'm going to guess right now that's not the first place you would go. You would probably go to JFK's assassination. Is that right?
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
guys, this is fun. We're just having fun here. If you like listening, like, subscribe, comment, and share. We're looking for everybody to get involved here. We want your opinions. We love the discussion, and ultimately, we're gonna find something, whether it's the truth or confirmation of whatever it used to be. But we're gonna keep going on what we've been doing the last couple episodes. I think four episodes now. We're gonna go back to the Fillmore report, and we're gonna take a look again. And the first thing is the missing tooth. We're gonna go over the missing tooth for John Dillinger. I'm gonna share the screen. If you're following along on YouTube, this is a good moment. You can really see it here. The missing tooth freeze frame from when he was captured after Phoenix and was right before Crown Point. He got put away in Crown Point. So you could see he's like laughing. And what's crazy, we talked about this video too, is that what is he laughing at so hard? Because it was a really big smile. So that's why you can see the missing tooth.
Yeah, if you actually see this in video, clearly someone says something to him, and it just cracks him up. And you know, this is he gives this big grin, and you could tell that everybody there thought this was hilarious, whatever it was. And I just wish there were audio of it. It would be fantastic to hear.
When Dillinger was initially incarcerated at Crown Point, Indiana jail, I'm reading now, by the way, right from the report, in January 1934, he was filmed and photographed by reporters while standing with the district attorney, Robert Estelle, and Sheriff Lillian Holly. In one particular moment, he's filmed having this hearty laugh, and doing so, his upper teeth were clearly visible, and the smile revealed him to have either a missing or partially missing upper right canine tooth. The following photos were taken from the film footage. Yes, it definitely doesn't look like a piece of spinach.
No.
There's right. reference in the FBI Dillinger file to Dillinger having a gold tooth. However, there is no additional confirmation or reference to the gold tooth. The dental records of Dillinger were available for both the U.S. Navy and the Indiana prison records. Those records show that Dillinger had an additional missing tooth as well, although they cannot be seen in available photos or film. Unlike other identifying factors that can change postmortem, like the previously described clouding in the eyeballs, the teeth do not change after death. The forensic identification standards of the day, dental identification would have been second only to fingerprints in scientific priority and certainty. Despite its potential significance for identification, the official autopsy on Dillinger completely omitted the description of the teeth. And finally, other than the mention of a possible gold tooth, there is no documented effort in the FBI files to describe Dillinger's dental condition. Would you say that they omitted it on purpose?
Possibly. I'm not willing to necessarily rule that out, but it is strange that there wasn't a description of the teeth. The FBI, I think, at that point was so certain that they had Dillinger through the fingerprint identification. That was the DNA of the day. That was the most definitive means of identification. They claimed very, very quickly after the Biograph shooting that, you know, the fingerprints matched. It was a positive identification. It was Dillinger. And so I don't know if Dr. Kearns was aware of that, if he had already heard that. Maybe I know the Bureau was present at the autopsy, and so Kearns must have been aware of that. And so I think something that examining the teeth and giving a description of the teeth for identification purposes, maybe he just decided, you know, these boys already got him identified through the fingerprints. I'm not going to bother with the teeth. That's could be a very reasonable and plausible explanation for why.
Doesn't that seem? Go ahead, Todd. It looks like
I was going to say, you know, it's been 90 years later in the internet, and we talked about this maybe on the last podcast. But when you look at it, he says as he's dying, "You got me, boys." Isn't that good enough right there? That was Dillinger. He whispered it. He said, "You got me, boys."
Yep, case closed.
Yeah. So and I think one of the things, Todd, that we discussed in that conversation was that Dillinger has taken a 45 round to the sixth cervical vertebra that deflected up and went straight up his spinal cord and exited out his just below his right eye. He was still the heart was still beating when he hit the ground, but I doubt he was conscious. So,
but I think he has the most quotes for last words said, because I think another one said, didn't he say like bye bye birdie,
bye bye birdie? I think he sang bye, a little bye, song. Yes. Yeah,
yes. Yeah.
You got me, G men, stuff like right. that.
Yeah.
For those listening, they're kidding. We don't know what he said. There's conflicting reports. If you miss the last set, yeah. I don't think if you have severed your spinal cord at the bottom of your brain cell, like the brainstem, right. I doubt you're saying anything.
Right.
Is there a possibility that Dr. Kearns, because we talked about this too, we don't feel as if Dr. Kearns was a nefarious character. We don't feel like he was somebody who was doing a disservice in order to help the FBI. We think he was just doing his job. But why would he miss this if he was a pro? Why would he miss that, especially if it was the second way of identifying a body?
Yeah, again, my thought is that he was aware that the body had already been identified through the fingerprints. And so, I don't know, this is the most egregious heat wave in Chicago history that night. And let's get this damn thing over with.
Yeah, he wants to get home.
Or was he pressured?
Or was he pressured? Exactly. And
it's like what we talked about before, Stuart. We had brought up the JFK case of stuff came out recently that there was people that pressured the medical examiner.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, there was pressure brought against certainly one of the doctors that was present at Parkland, and I know that for a fact. So
Hoover obviously would have been on the phone with Purvis during this, and we have no idea what marching orders was given. No. But I would assume Hoover would want to know 100% in a quick fashion that was John.
Oh man, big time. I promise you, one of the first orders of the day was to get his fingerprints. And again, that's something to me that is really interesting. And I think I pointed out somewhere in the report, probably not right here, but is that there's not a lot of detail as to who actually did the fingerprint examination that made the positive identification. It's just, you know, put out to the world that he's been identified. The fingerprints match, boom, case closed. But there is not a specific report that details who did it, what the specific points of identification were. And we're going to get further into this in the fingerprints, because this is another area that's questionable.
We might need 2 hours for the fingerprints for you, Stuart.
Yeah, exactly. So you're exactly right, Travis. I promise you the first order of business from Hoover would have been to get those fingerprints.
This is good stuff. This is good questions. I'm really...
And Melvin Purvis was... He was the boss up in Chicago, right?
So yes, Melvin Purvis was what in the FBI we call them SACs. Todd, in the Secret Service, you guys call them SACs, but it's the special agent in charge of that field office. And so Melvin Purvis was in charge of that field office. Now, because he had he was effectively being in Chicago, so much of the Dillinger case was worked out of Chicago. And there was so much media attention on the Dillinger case. Melvin Purvis actually started getting more publicity than J. Edgar Hoover did. And I think, you know, at some point, a lot of people in the public thought that Melvin Purvis was the director of the FBI rather than J. Edgar Hoover. Well, we can't have that.
Yeah, so pissing J. Edgar Hoover off.
Yeah, so effectively, Hoover, without demoting Purvis per se. In other words, Purvis stayed on as the SAC or the special agent charge. But Hoover moved in a guy named Sam Cowley, who was, I think he held the title of inspector at the time. And effectively Callie moves into Chicago and he is Hoover's eyes and ears and effectively has say over whatever happens in Chicago. So I guess on paper, Purvis wasn't demoted, but effectively he was because of the presence of Cowley. And now Cowley will end up later on being killed in a gunfight against Babyface Nelson. But
Purvis eventually quits the FBI, right?
He does. Yeah. He, I think
goes to California.
So this all happened in 1934. I want to say Purvis actually quits the FBI in 1935. And then he was from South Carolina. I think maybe a lawyer from there. Don't know what he did in the intervening years, but you know, Purvis ends up committing suicide in 1960. And it's some reports. I know the Dillinger 73 movie, you know, at the end of it says that Purvis killed himself with the same gun that he killed Dillinger with. Well, that's actually false because Purvis was not one of the official shooters. And I'm not sure it's actually clear what gun Purvis killed himself with. And believe it or not, on that, there's a few questions about that because I want to say some issues came out about that might have been around the time that the guy from 1959 comes forward and says, hey, I'm Dillinger. You didn't get me. You know, and Purvis the next year commits suicide. There's some issues or connections with that. But
I got a couple of things. One, you know, Purvis's son's still alive, Austin. Yes. Purvis. He's 80 something years old. Two, the gun that Melvin Purvis committed suicide with, the owner of the Dillinger Museum in Nashville, Indiana, killed himself with the exact same gun in the museum.
I never knew that, Travis. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
The and owner what? Of the Holy. Museum killed himself with the gun that Purvis killed himself with in the museum. Is that what you're saying?
Remind me yeah. of his name, the owner.
I'd have to... Hold on, let me see if I can bring it up because I forget his name.
I could get it in a multiple choice question.
Well, let me just add this too. I think Purvis goes out to California and helps out technical stuff on movies in Hollywood about FBI. And he starts the Junior G-Man Club. And at one point, he has like 260,000 kids in his G-Man Junior Club.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, see, all this stuff, he you know, kind of upends Hoover, you know, and so Hoover sees Purvis as competition, man, because, you know, the public sees Purvis as the man that got Dillinger, not Hoover.
And his name is Joe Pinkston.
Joe Pinkston, yeah. Wow, I never knew that, man. That is breaking news here on the Digging Up Dillinger podcast. Wow.
Don't be throwing around breaking news, Stuart. You're not allowed.
Yeah. That's right. I'm not the journalist here. Sorry.
No, I'll tell you. First of all, breaking news. This is another sidebar, but breaking news is the dumbest thing I think that news does because it's breaking. It doesn't. It just is it's a word to catch your attention.
Yes.
And and nothing can be breaking really in this podcast unless we go out and do something, and then it's happening. But yeah, that's really interesting, Travis. Good job, man. That's.
Yeah, wow.
I didn't know that one.
You yeah. should have said, clear the airways, and then told us that.
Well, there's I don't know if this is true, but I've always heard it, that he did it at the foot of Dillinger's wax figure. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's
creepy
urban legend,
as all get out, dude. That's creepy.
Really is. Wow, man.
Was he looking at it?
I mean, I've always heard that. I have always heard that. That's how it went down. But, I mean, again... You know, I was
a
little kid, so I.
Where's the gun today?
I'm not sure where that gun is.
So I think the entire contents of that museum, didn't they end up at that the South Shore, Indiana tourist
hearing, yeah.
thing or place or whatever?
Yeah.
Yep. South Shore Visitors Bureau.
Yeah, it's in Hammond, Indiana.
Yep.
They had a little Dillinger museum up there for a while.
Yeah, I think that's one of our major problems is not problems, but challenges is we have to track down a lot of these artifacts over time, we start losing him. And Travis, you know that too, from just, you know, obviously being a part of the family and being a part of these museums. Some of them closed down, like Crown Point. That one's done, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was the same thing. That's where the South Shore thing started, was at the Crown Point, and there was some lawsuit issues that you know, I guess we won't get into, but
here's another fad thing I'm hearing about is that the Crown Point jail where John was held at is also closed due to some issues with I don't know what's going on up there, but with the town or something, but that's what I've heard.
That's too bad, man, because that's a really cool place. Really cool.
Yes.
If you'd like to help the Crown Point Jail, please email us at diggingupdillinger@gmail.com. Guys, we've kind of diverged, and I know my job as host is to kind of right the ship here.
Yep, rein us back in. Come on.
We're having fun. If you know, frankly, if you guys have a problem with us going off on these cool stories, forget about you, all right? You can, you know, kick rocks. But this is Advanced Dillinger. We told you this at the beginning. I'm going to bring us back. Let's reel it back into the missing scars. We just talked about the missing tooth. It's interesting. I don't know how I feel about it. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much is it influencing my thoughts on whether it's him or not? I'd say it's right in the middle at a 5. Like, it's not pushing me towards it's him and pushing me away from it's not him. I don't know. I can't really. I think it's interesting for sure. It's another question. Right. How do you guys feel about it?
So again,
about the missing tooth.
So again, this is all circumstantial evidence. And again, I think we've talked about, you know, most people they consider, well, circumstantial evidence is somehow inferior or somehow not credible. You can't, if it's circumstantial, you have to discount it. Nothing could be further from the truth in reality. Because, you know, think about the term smoking gun. Oh, you know, that what's the smoking gun of the case? Well, guess what? A smoking gun is circumstantial evidence. Direct witness testimony is direct evidence. And as we've said before, sometimes it can be very unreliable. And so many times you need circumstantial evidence to establish the context for the direct evidence. So, you know, again, the tooth by itself, if someone said, oh, the whole Dillinger case hinges on this missing tooth, and the pathologist did not describe that in the report, I'd say, so what? No big deal. Let's move on. But, you know, you
everything have to combined take, with it.
Exactly. You have to take what we're talking about in the context of all these things. And that's what initially, when I started looking into this, taking this in the context of everything, I just kept going, I can't believe how many things there are here that all seem to, you know, go to the same thing. Like, well, it just, you don't have a positive identification of Dillinger.
I love it. I love it. And Todd, you look like you're going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if you thought about the autopsy that night, if the FBI would have brought the body in and said, hey, we just found this body in the alley, how did this person die? Maybe there would have been more done to it. But I think they presented it at the autopsy, like, hey, this is John Dillinger. We shot him. It's not going to trial. It's not going to court.
Yep.
And just the autopsy is just done quickly. And again, is this something that he could have overlooked by just quickly trying to get it done?
Yep. And I think, honestly, that is the most reasonable explanation. That's most likely what happened.
I love it. I also think we need to put historical context on this as well. The way I look at it is, think about the social phenomenon that was John Dillinger over a year time, right? 14-month period. And then now we're looking at it 90 years. Maybe we're putting too much weight on, like, oh, he's so famous. Like, he really was, but like, also we are glorifying him years later, and we're looking into this mystery because we're putting so much effort, emphasis on it. Maybe, you know, think about it. Like, this guy has been running for 14 months. It's only been a year. Yeah, he's a social phenomenon, but he was a fad. right? It was something that came up and came down, and this was the end of him. And it was kind of like, all right, it's not like we're asking, one of the presidents died, right? And this is the autopsy. It's not like that Dr. Kearns was like, this is the autopsy, like JFK's autopsy, where it's like, oh my gosh, this is the biggest thing in history. You know, it was just kind of like it was a gangster who ran and got shot and killed by the, you know, we're putting a way more emphasis on it. So maybe bringing it back down, at least in my mind, bringing it back into reality of let's go back and put ourselves in that moment. It's not as big to them as it would be to us if we were there now, time traveling, back to the time travel conversation.
Now, Stuart, on that point, if they 100% believed it was him,
yeah,
they did the report, they notified him, why would they still come? Why would agents still come back to the family after the fact, months after the fact?
Yeah, yeah.
And show up with John Sr. at Crown Hill Cemetery at the gravesite.
Right.
Seems like you're leading our listeners into what we're going to talk about a little bit later too, Travis.
I'm sorry. I understand we're looking at it this way. I just certain things like that. Like if we're done, he's done.
Yes.
You know, that's why I'm like wondering, did they purposely hurry this up?
Yeah. So, again, Joe, you make a very reasonable point, and that's what I want to stress is that each one of these things that we point out that regarding this autopsy and some other things actually not related to the autopsy that are, that maybe question the identity of Dillinger is, again, this stuff has to be taken in context, and it has to be taken that there's a certain number of them. And again, I'll allude to this again about the pearl necklace. So you don't have a necklace until you have a certain number of pearls on it, right? And that's the thing. There's a certain tipping point, and there's no hard and fast rule of where that tipping point is when you have enough evidence to really question something. Because every case, every investigation, no matter what it is, has some anomalous or some unanswered or mysterious aspects to it that you just don't have answers for. Also, every investigation has some kind of administrative or human mistake where something is overlooked. Something is just, some aspect of the investigation is not done. It's nothing necessarily nefarious or corrupt. It's just that we're dealing with human beings in all aspects of these things, and human beings make mistakes. And so, again, there's a certain number of mistakes that just are going to happen in the course of a case. They're just going to happen. But you have to ask yourself, when do you say, man, there's just so many of these unexplained things. There's so many seeming mistakes here. When do we really start questioning it? And that's just the point I got to where I said, had I been the case agent on this, I just wouldn't have been satisfied with all these unanswered questions.
Yeah. Yeah. At some point they seemed overwhelming.
Yeah.
Especially that night. Why didn't they go to Anna Sage's apartment and search it?
Exactly. Yes. Oh my God, that should have been done. Someone should have stayed with her, but they let her go. No one went with her. No one escorted her. It's just like, hey, we got him. Okay. Hey, see you later.
What a weird life what a weird thing that is.
Yeah, I know. No, absolutely. She should have been detained right there. What we haven't also said was, not only was Dillinger with Anna Sage that night, he was actually, I guess, dating, maybe is the word, one of Anna's girls, whatever the viewer wants to take from that, because Anna Sage was a madam. But Dillinger was dating a lady named Polly Hamilton. And that was his, I guess that was his girlfriend at the time. So Dillinger was with Anna Sage and Polly Hamilton. Both Hamilton and Sage were allowed to leave that night. So, Dillinger's been on the run for 14 months. They didn't have a clue where he was after Little Bohemia and, where a civilian was killed, as we pointed out. And so, you would think that Anna Sage and Polly Hamilton have been with him for the last month at least. You want to fill those blanks in. I mean, because at this point, you've got maybe Dillinger, but they're all the members of the Dillinger gang are still on the run. Dillinger was with Homer Van Meter most of those last few weeks and months of his life. Man, Anna Sage and Polly Hamilton could have given you so much intelligence on what else is going on.
A cache of information. Yep.
Absolutely. And you let them go that night, that's just nuts.
This really is, again, attributed to, in my mind, that they're just infants, FBI infants. You know, this is just a new process, and they're just not thinking clearly and, like, you know, what we know in hindsight 2020. Right.
Yes, there is absolutely some element of that, because a lot of this was new. This was a new kind of crime. This was a new kind of thing that had never really been experienced before in law enforcement. So, yes, there is a certain element of that. But regardless, it just seems that common sense just says, and again, I'm biased just looking at it through modern eyes, but
that's a good one,
it just common sense just says, oh my God, they need to stay here. I know somebody needs to go talk to them. We need to get all the info we can from them.
But you know, to cut them some slack in this investigation, when we talk about Little Bohemia, we know that they found a gun there. The FBI recovers a pistol, and I think they track it from the manufacturer. They track it down to Fort Worth, Texas, where the manufacturer had sold it to. They go through records. Fort Worth sold it to a guy in San Antonio. The FBI interview the guy in San Antonio, and they ask about Dillinger, but the FBI agents in San Antonio don't have a picture of Dillinger to show the guy if that he bought that. Now, again, we're looking at this in 2024, and you can't even believe that they wouldn't have a picture.
Exactly.
Of somebody that they've been looking for.
Somebody that they're going to positively identify, where they're confident enough to actually fire bullets at, you know, just a month later or less. It's crazy.
That's what we're talking about.
What's even crazier than that, we know that John Dillinger left stuff in his room in Little Bohemia.
Yep.
And how do we know that, boys?
Well, I know it because I saw it. Because there's actually a suitcase up at Little Bohemia at that. And then I think, Travis, you guys actually have some of that stuff as well.
We did. We did have the suitcase that was sent back. And it had other gang members' clothing artifacts and John's, and a ring was all inside a suitcase.
Yeah.
And you have that ring today, Travis.
I do. Oh, I just don't have it on right now.
Yeah, he just doesn't wear it every day. Only on special podcasts.
Yeah.
Dude, this is great. This is great. All right. Ready for Missing Scars?
Let's do it.
You guys ready? Are you okay?
Bring it on.
God,
bring it on.
You guys are... You guys,
I know, we're getting sidetracked. No,
no, no, no, no, no. Yeah, we are, but we're we are knocking this out of the park, dude. We will keep with the baseball references this entire podcast as our themes.
What inning are we in right now, then?
Who's up, God, we're in the,
who's on first?
We're in the middle of the first inning, guys. We put three outs down. all right, so the missing scars is another argument for the Fillmore Report. I'm just going to read a little bit. Interrupt, obviously, Stuart, as you feel necessary, and everybody else. The FBI identification order, commonly called a wanted poster, issued for John Dillinger, described a 1/2-inch scar on the back of the left hand and a scar of unstated length on the middle of the upper lip. Neither of these scars are described or included in the autopsy performed on Dillinger by Dr. Kearns. This is in contrast to several other detailed descriptions Dr. Kearns included in the report of scars on the body. See, it just bothers me that he's including scar report, but not missing teeth. Anyway, in series of contradictory statements of the FBI after Dillinger's death, Dr. Lozier and Cassidy, who, if you remember, performed a plastic surgery on Dillinger in two sessions, described work that included removal of some moles, filling in a chin dimple, and unspecified work on the tip of the nose, and removal of the scar on the upper lip. This might explain why Dr. Kearns omitted the known scar Dillinger had in the upper lip. However, it is unlikely that Dr. Lozier or Cassidy, who were two highly disreputable individuals whose medical expertise must be questioned, could have performed such a nuanced procedure without leaving a hint of a scar. Dr. Cassidy was so inept, he almost killed Dillinger by overdosing him on ether at the start of the operation. Okay. Also, the exact methods carried out in the surgical procedures was not described by either Lozier or Cassidy, but it is also unlikely that either would have had the expertise to cut on the tip of the nose or fill in a chin dimple without leaving a hint of a scar. But no scarring was described by Dr. Kearns in the autopsy on either the nose or the chin. Should I keep going, guys? Or sure. Stuart, can I say something?
Okay, let me just ask this. Travis, did the family ever talk about how he got those scars?
Not to my recollection at all. I mean, my father may know more, but I did not hear those.
Write it down. My question. I'm serious. We need to start taking down the mic.
We really
questions.
Do. Yeah.
He needs exactly. to get on the show.
What was the other one? What was the other one? It was. I'm getting a piece of paper, by the way. So the mic questions. It was.
Well, it had to do with Audrey identifying the childhood scar that Audrey had.
Yeah.
And the childhood scar. Got it. I'm literally writing this down, folks. That we're not going to forget this because I want Mike Thompson on this podcast answering the good stuff.
Right. And just so folks know, this is kind of how an actual investigation proceeds. I mean, you know, you may sit down with some of the people that you work with and you have a series of facts. You don't have the full fact. You don't have the full puzzle, if you will. And, you know, you discuss these things, you hash it out. And, you know, we talk about who can we talk to that can fill in this piece of the puzzle and give us this information. And this is exactly how it works. So there's nothing, we're just in full transparency, you know, you folks are coming along with us on this investigation.
I love it. I'm coming with you too, baby. I'm here too. This is my first investigation. No. Regarding the omission of the 1/2-inch scar in the back of Dillinger's left hand, it is known that Dr. Kearns studied the hands of the body because he fully described the scarring of the fingerprints. Possibly it was an oversight, but a 1/2-inch scar would certainly be noticeable as the small scars on the would certainly be as noticeable as the small scars on the fingertips because he tried to burn off his fingerprints.
Yep.
In the autopsy report, Dr. Kearns described 2 vertical scars over the temporal mandible joints on both sides of the face. So I'm assuming the mandible jaw.
Yeah. Well, I think what that would describe would be some kind of a facelift. Some kind of a primitive, brutal facelift.
These scars might have been an attempt at a facelift. There you go. Which Dr. Lozier said, well, it's like you wrote it or something.
It's like I wrote it, man. Wow.
Contemplated, but not described in a statement regarding the procedures performed. Regardless, the scars were apparent and must add further doubt to his or Dr. Cassidy's ability to remove a previous scar, change the nose tip, or fill in a chin dimple without leaving a scar. The following photograph shows Dillinger in the morgue, and the vertical scar described by Dr. Kearns is apparent on the left side of the face.
Yeah.
Facelift. Weird. Dr. Kearns described a 2.5-inch square centimeter purple-red area in the sternum area of the body, mm-hmm. which is covered by a parchment-like membrane.
Yeah, I've pondered that many times as to what exactly he's describing, a parchment like membrane over the sternum. I think that somebody cut, you know, Lozier, these two alcoholic idiots that were doing this plastic surgery, you know, cut some skin from the chest, I guess over the sternum, and used that for whatever means they used it for to, you know, fill in dimples and that kind of stuff. Because that's all I can figure out what the autopsy is describing about this membrane that's on the chest.
And it's such an aware, the sternum area, right under our neck. Yeah, I mean, that's such a weird place. You wouldn't
really,
I mean,
is.
You can't assume like he was shot there. Like that would be a death blow.
Right.
That's interesting.
And there's no good photographs of Dillinger's chest from any of the morgue photos, you know, to get what Kearns is talking about. So that is just kind of another little mystery. It seems to me if you need extra skin, you know, to maybe graft in other places, you know, you'd get that out of the butt or somewhere else where there's a meatier skin than on the sternum, you know, because I can feel a few parts on me that maybe are a little softer than others, but my sternum right now, it's like, you know, man, there's not much there. So that had to be painful in itself, but I don't know if maybe that the skin, that specific skin right there was something that at the time they thought, hey, this is what we need for, you know, nose tissue or something. I don't know.
What a weird thing. And then also you could see in like his beard on the picture.
Yeah.
Like a filling in of nose of the chin dimple. Would they just like put collagen in it? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what did they do?
I don't know. You know,
these drunk idiots, man.
Exactly. I would think that they probably made some little incision and maybe stuffed some cotton in there or something. That would be more the logic they would have been following. Yeah.
This is so unsanitary. Let me ask you this, Stuart. Take a couple more shots of your whiskey. You know, okay. Finish your thing. I can see you're almost there. And then come up with an idea on how to fill in Travis's dimple, and that's probably how we did it.
I'm not agreeing to this.
Travis, listen, we're gonna take a couple scars. It won't be that bad. Just have a couple ether shots.
If it's
ether.
If it's for the investigative journey.
Yeah, exactly.
In the name of science, I'll do it.
That'd be really interesting to see, you know, someone who's like, I don't know, interested in historic, like cosmetic surgery.
Yeah.
Like what would they have done back then? And then influenced by drunk idiots who are trying to kill Dillinger.
Who I think only one of them, I think, actually ever even had a medical license. I'm forgetting now, but both of them had criminal records. One may have actually been a doctor at some point, but whichever one had been the doctor, they were long removed by 1934 of being a practicing doctor.
Got it.
And they were both practicing alcoholics and criminals.
But I think it goes back to how we talk about that they don't have a real good photograph and no one in the FBI has ever laid eyes on Dillinger. Why does Dillinger need to do all this?
Yo, great point, Todd.
Why do you need to change this? Unless he's
creating
an imposter to get shot to say that's Dillinger.
Hey, great point. Exactly.
Yeah. And that way they look at the imposter and they say, well, he doesn't have the scar like Dillinger has.
Yep.
And then they all say, well, he had plastic surgery.
How do they know he had plastic surgery too?
Do we really interview the two doctors?
The two doctors, and there was actually they did this at a guy's house, and I'm forgetting his name. His first name was Jimmy. Maybe I'm wrong about Jimmy because actually Dillinger was supposedly using the alias of Jimmy Lawrence. I want to say also that the guy's name was Jimmy that they did this plastic surgery at, and he was an underworld figure again, you know, a quasi criminal in himself, you know, that he allowed this to happen, and he was allowing them to hide out in his place at the time too.
We only got 5 minutes left for the podcast.
Yeah, so let's get to something real quick on the scars.
Go for it.
Yeah, so one thing that to me really jumped out about the scars was Dillinger was shot in March of 1934 during a bank robbery in Mason City, Iowa. And he was shot actually by a local businessman from a window looking down where the bank robbery was happening. And Dillinger went and actually got treatment from an underworld doctor. The underworld doctor was later interviewed by the FBI. He gave very detailed description of where the wound was, the wound he treated, where it was located. And he described it as being like in the lower right shoulder. So when Dillinger is autopsied, Kearns writes up the report. He gives a he does not describe anything in the right shoulder region. Just simply that there's a scar. I think on the maybe the right side of the lower neck. So again, you have two differing accounts from one doctor that treats the wound and one doctor that sees the scar. That again, if that was the only thing you're talking about, I would say that's just two guys that just, maybe you're not remembering exactly. Again, it's just something else that adds to this thing that we have these, the scars are just not in the same place.
Another pearl
on the necklace.
You guys are great. This is, if you're enjoying this, please tell others about it. We have fingerprints. We have, the fingerprints next, for sure.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the handwriting also. Handwriting.
We have guys writing in saying they're Dillinger.
Yeah, my favorite one is the guy from 1959 and 1961 saying I'm 1963, excuse me. So 4 years later. By the way, taking a selfie of himself, pretty cool. Yeah. Probably one of the first selfies ever.
Joe.
And sending
You not being a boomer, you won't know this, but I remember from my childhood there were these photo booths where you could go into, and I think it was probably a quarter. You put a quarter in, and you sit.
It was probably a nickel at your time, but go ahead. Yeah.
and it takes these pictures of you, and then you go outside this little booth and you wait, and then a few minutes later, these I think it's a series of four pictures come out, then the machine spits out, and you've got that.
That's what, something like this,
something exactly like that. Got yep. And so that's what that picture looks like to me of that guy that sent it in.
You're right. God, you're right. You're always. Right.
He's the FBI. He's always right.
Listen, he's retired. He's not always
retired.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Formerly retired. This has been fun. Another fun episode. We keep coming. We'll come back with more. And as always, guys, we got to keep digging.
Yep.
That's it.
Love it.
All right. Any last words?
The fingerprints are going to be a good one. That's going to be a good one.
It's going to be a good one.
Yes.
We're going to need the full. We might go into two parts on the fingerprints, but it depends on how much whiskey Stuart has. All right, all. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Take care, guys. See you.
Thank you.
The Digging Up Dillinger podcast is produced by Joe Melillo and Grace Hiles. Theme music produced by Eddie Bandis. Follow us on TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, keep digging.